This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuture, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly opportunity to field your questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the destination. And today, as usual, I share the podium with our nutritionist in residence, Layla Mudin. And Layla, how are you doing?
All right, Dr. Hoffman. How are you? Starting to get cold.
Starting to get cold?
Yeah.
But I got to tell you.
I had to bring out an extra blanket.
I'm trying to cold acclimate. So this last weekend, believe it or not, I didn't think I was going to do it again, but I did another outdoor water swim in Peconic Bay.
Oh my goodness!
56 degrees, and I got it. It was doable. I wouldn't say it was pleasant.
In a wetsuit
with a neoprene cap and neoprene gloves.
Yeah.
And I did that, and
were your teeth chattering? I couldn't stand that.
I did jump into a warm bathtub afterwards.
Oh, good. Okay. So your teeth were chattery.
And I made sure that I rode outside because, I mean, ordinarily this time of year I'd be in a comfortable indoor swimming pool, but my gym is closed, of course.
Yeah.
And so that's the limitation. So dealing with that, I'm doing a lot more outdoor exercise, trying to, do workarounds.
How long were you in the water?
I was in the water about 25 minutes, which is a little less than usual. So I checked my watch and I said, actually could have kept going, but I said, what's the point? I had to broadcast that day, so I decided, let's not put myself into hypothermia.
Exactly.
Because welcome to Intelligent Medicine.
I decided to
give myself ample time to warm up.
So. Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, so, yeah, I mean, look, trying to do this workaround around COVID-19, which seems to, unfortunately, the specter of COVID-19 is rearing its ugly head again.
There is
definitely a second wave.
Yeah.
We've got a lot more cases. People are dying, but at far less of a rate.
Yes.
They know what they're doing now.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
They're avoiding some of the rookie mistakes that they made with this. I think a lot of it had to do with overzealous ventilating.
Yeah.
That, for a lot of patients, I think was the death knell. So they're really avoiding that if possible. And they're using anticoagulant medication, anti-inflammatory medication.
Yeah.
Combination of therapies that seems to obviate the risk. But here is a story, before we get to questions. Yet another study suggests there's a link between obesity and COVID-19 risk. So this is what's called a meta-analysis. You know what that is, but I'll reiterate it for our audience. A meta-analysis is a study of studies, so that, like, if one study says this and another study says that, it's like the weighted average of studies. And their conclusion is, not surprisingly, that adults with coronavirus disease who are obese had a 113% higher risk of being hospitalized and a 48% higher risk of dying from the disease than normal weight or simply overweight adults.
113%. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So this study was in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association. And, they discuss it. I posted this on Facebook, so for our listeners, they can go back and look at that post. They say that the effect size surprised even a guy named Barry Popkin, who is a renowned nutrition researcher at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
He was surprised at the magnitude of the risk. So, you know, it kind of explains, you know, why did the U.S. get so hit so hard? We have the highest rate of obesity of any country. And then, you know, you look at some of the hot spots for COVID-19, you know, places like El Paso, Texas, you know, where there's a really high rate of obesity. Mm-hmm. And people are, unfortunately, kind of sitting ducks for this.
It's a call to action to all, you know, everybody needs to take better care of themselves.
Yeah, that I mean, not just
maintaining a healthy weight, eating well.
It puts it sort of into gives it a sense of immediacy. And we tend to think, well, yeah, I'm overweight, but, you know, maybe that's a problem that's going to affect me 20 years hence. But in the here and now, it puts you at risk of dying.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. We've got a question from Michael. Mm-hmm. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I was taking candibactin AR and BR for SIBO, and I had good results in terms of reduction of diarrhea
Let's
and
gas.
Let's
explain what the SIBO is.
Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. That's what SIBO is the acronym
associated
for.
Associated with irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes, yes. Mostly associated with that. And candibactin AR and BR are very
natural
good therapies.
Natural antibacterials.
Exactly. Very good therapies to eradicate SIBO.
The BR has a lot of berberine in it. That's why it's called BR. And then the AR has a lot of aromatic herbs.
Yes.
Like rosemary extract and oregano extract, which they work, that those two formulas work synergistically against the bacteria that overgrow in SIBO. Good products.
So,
available, and by the way, via full script. You know, you hear about some things on the, like, what the heck is that? Where am I going to go to full script off my website?
Exactly. You know, go to drhoffman.com. Go to the store.
Go to the store. Click on that. It'll take you to full script. You can sign up and you can order products if you want to engage in self-care.
So Michael was taking candibactin AR and BR for SIBO. He did well with reduction in diarrhea and gas. However, after about 2 months, the symptoms resumed. Could it be that the AR and BR lost their efficacy?
Yes.
Because another strain of microbes emerged?
Yes. Very good thinking. Yes.
Yeah.
It's like antibiotic resistance.
Yeah.
Even you can get resistance to natural antimicrobials.
Right, right, right. That's interesting. And he asks, is it possible that SIBO can be dealt with by closing the ileocecal valve through some type of body therapy that chiropractors?
Yeah, chiropractors do an adjustment on the ileocecal valve, and that's the popular move. You know, there is some element of what's called dysmotility.
Yeah.
Or sometimes there's kind of a stasis, or in the case of the ileocecal valve, there's a leakage of the lower intestinal contents up into the small intestine. So that valve is supposed to be very effective at preventing that basically backflow of bacteria.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe there's something to that. I can't speak to it because I don't use that technique, but chiropractors do.
Yeah, yeah. He's also asking if SIBO can be caused by a malfunction of the migratory motor complex.
Yeah, that's, you know, like impaired peristalsis.
Oh, impaired peristalsis.
Yeah, like gastroparesis or
something.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Sure.
It can.
Yeah.
Absolutely can.
This migratory thing, it's basically the worm-like undulations of your
GI tract.
Yeah. Which was fascinating to me when I was a medical student. I remember the first time I observed an operation, you know, you stood there and the patient's abdomen was gaping wide open. We were holding it with retractors. And even, you know, the patient was asleep and anesthetized. You could see these wave-like undulations, contractions.
Wow, even under anesthesia.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't stop.
It doesn't stop. It's always going, right?
And that's the, what's it called, the migratory motor complex?
That's what he's, migratory motor complex.
Yeah. Hmm. Boy, I haven't heard that term for a while.
Wow. So, Michael, yes, it could be because of that, the other strain of microbes emerging due to the therapy that you're on. Sometimes it may be beneficial for some people to switch over.
To rotate.
Maybe try biocidin.
Nice.
It's also very good.
Which is black walnut as a major ingredient, but other things.
And other things. Remember Alamex?
Alamex. Alamex. Yes.
That's the other garlic for the allicin.
It's a very potent garlic. And unlike chiolic aged garlic extract, which is great for cardiovascular and great for
blood pressure
and great for immunity, doesn't have allicin. Mm-hmm. Allicin, as a specific ingredient of garlic, has a pretty strong antimicrobial effect.
Yeah.
That's the type of garlic you want to use for SIBO. And the product is called Alamex. I think it's still available.
It is. I believe it's still available. But it's the allicin in the garlic.
Very
potent. You know, beyond eating cloves of garlic, which you can do.
Let me point out that another therapy that can be helpful for...
Atrantil.
And Atrantil contains something called quebracho. Quebracho.
Quebracho.
Which sounds like a Latin American dance.
Yeah.
Or like a...
Or a food.
Or quebracho. A restaurant. I'll have some quebracho.
Have some quebracho with that?
Well, it's a type of heartwood extract, which when fed to flatulent animals, reduces their flatulence.
Oh,
and
there
so, inspired by that, they took this and tested it in humans, and they found that it tends to reduce bacterial proliferation and reduce gas, bloating, and possibly diarrhea. It's also pretty good for the methane predominant type of
SIBO.
There's
a hydrogen predominant and the methane.
Methane predominant. Methane predominant is hard to treat.
Yeah.
So... there you have it, Atrantil. Okay. Atrantil.
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 Thank you, Michael. You always send us such very, very thoughtful questions.
One of our astute questioners.
Yes. We have, let's see. Oh, we've got another Michael. This is another Michael.
Okay.
Good day, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. I've been doing intermittent fasting with good results for 7 years. I'm also taking Synthroid daily for hypothyroidism. My question is this, will the sugars used as the binders and fillers in the Synthroid cause my body to respond and break the fast? I'm reluctant to take the Synthroid in the morning due to this concern.
Interesting.
It's a little pill.
Yeah. I think it's a very small amount.
I wonder if it's just insignificant.
Yeah.
It's that small.
Yeah. It's not like, you know, some people think of these things like peanut allergy, like the kiss of death, you know, like... a girl kisses her boyfriend who just had a peanut butter sandwich, and she goes in anaphylaxis and dies with the minute, you know, just a few molecules of peanut antigen can send someone into a tizzy. With things like lactose intolerance or things like, you know, insulin resistance, I think the infinitesimal amounts are not going to be a big trigger.
Exactly.
But talk to us a little bit about the fillers that make people aware about some of the fillers that are in these things.
It could be lactose. It could be maltodextrin.
Right.
It could be some other type of gluten source.
There's titanium dioxide, which is not great for our patients with IBD.
Right. That's a microparticle. That's not a great idea either.
So there's some not great things in these tabletings.
Mm-hmm. I know for our celiac patients, these things would have to be compounded. Especially any medication, starch would have to be wheat or something. Sure, yeah, any type of starch you can assume is a gluten source in many of these medications. So that's something to watch for. That's really something to watch for.
That could be problematic, even relatively small amounts.
Yeah, Michael, I don't think you have to worry about your Synthroid in the morning breaking your fast. Just take it with water and carry on.
And apropos of that, I wrote an article about why people might prefer taking natural thyroid over Synthroid.
That's such a great article, Dr. Hoffman. That's really good.
It just to summarize, and I'll be talking more about it, is that one of the knocks on natural thyroid is that, well, it's not really standardized, it's old-fashioned, it's the way they used to get it. They used to take pig thyroids and throw them into a vat and then desiccate them and freeze-dry them and concentrate them, and that's old-fashioned. We're going to use Synthroid, which is a synthetic thyroid preparation, much more modern, more efficient. It's more something that we can standardize more.
Yeah.
And so the knock on the natural is that we don't know what you're getting. I mean, they say it's 30 milligrams, but it might be, 41.5 or it might be 19.3. We don't really know.
Yeah, yeah.
So they tested this out in a large study. And what they found is that the ability to achieve a normal TSH, which is the standard for, you know, optimal thyroid dosing was the same, whether they took natural thyroid or whether they took Synthroid. So that kind of overturned that. And then accompanying that were a lot of editorials saying, well, patients really, many of them respond better to natural thyroid. And then in the article, if you go to my article, check it out at drhoffman.com.
Yes.
I summarize a lot of the articles which talk about how much better patients feel when they take natural thyroid.
You know, I would even recommend, Dr. Hoffman, that is such a... All of your articles are wonderful, but this is so well put together that I would encourage any patient who's having trouble communicating with their doctor or endocrinologist about, I still don't feel well, and you keep telling me my labs are normal. Bring this article to them.
Yeah.
Urge them, encourage them to read this article.
Yeah.
And they will
And why they'll listen.
They will think.
I thank you for saying that. But
why
they'll listen is that I only quote articles from peer-reviewed medical journals in there. It's not like merely an opinion piece off the top of my head. I'm quoting research from journals that doctors read and that the doctors, you know, now really need to pay attention to the new findings about this, and that should vindicate natural thyroid. It makes such a difference for patients.
Yes.
You remember the patient we talked to earlier today. I mean, she was really miserable when I met her.
Yeah.
I've been treating her for like almost, I think, 20 years now, and we're adjusting, you know, we're playing around a little bit with her natural thyroid now. In an abundance of caution, I cut her back. I have to put her, reinstate some of it. I think she was on a little too much. As you age, I think we should adjust downward because we have to be careful we're not overstressing the heart or causing osteoporosis.
Yeah.
So I cut her back. I mean, my goodness, it's been such a revolution for her because she came in extremely, you know how vivacious she is. She's over 80.
Yeah.
But
she's very active.
She's very active. Mm-hmm. And she was so lethargic when she first came, almost expressionless, almost like... like she almost looked like a Parkinson's patient when she first came in.
Oh, boy.
And such a turnaround when she went on the natural thyroid. Mm-hmm. Her endocrinologist was super unhappy with me that I switched her to natural thyroid. Mm. But she doesn't talk to her endocrinologist anymore.
He's not her endocrinologist anymore.
No.
There you go. Oh, my goodness. We've got an email from Silvio. Dr. Hoffman, my wife Paula is 74 years old, and she's had osteopenia for many years. What 74-year-old wouldn't?
Right. Just to clarify.
Yeah.
Osteopenia is not a disease.
It's not a medical condition.
It's a physiological fact.
Yeah.
It's like hair thinning.
Yeah.
It's like wrinkles.
It's not a condition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dry skin.
Age-related normal, changes.
Something like that.
So, I mean, yes, it is something that we should pay attention to. It's potentially a harbinger of a medical condition, which is osteoporosis.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe she has average bone density for a 74-year-old.
Yeah. Well, she was on Fosamax for 3 years, 15 years ago.
Okay.
So when she was about 60, 59. Okay. She was recently diagnosed with osteoporosis from a bone density scan. She had a decline of 4% from the scan from 2 years ago. It's only in the spine. She's been taking supplements that include strontium for a few years. I'm sure the doctor will recommend treatment.
Supplements that include strontium may not be giving an adequate amount of strontium.
Right. I'm sure the doctor wants to treat her medically. What would you advise? And this is from a loving and concerned husband.
I gotta say, quite frankly, I would advise a medical consult because I don't know the circumstance.
Right.
I mean, that's a very typical visit. I think maybe 10% of our visits now are on osteoporosis.
If she was on Fosamax in her late 50s, what's going on? Wait. That's still too soon to have osteoporosis.
What are the risk
and
factors?
Why were they giving her Fosamax for osteopenia?
That's
a problem.
That's not even the package insert for it says it's not for that, it's for osteoporosis.
Right.
You know, in an effort to forestall something later.
Yeah. So Silvio, your wife needs a workup. She might have some malabsorption kind of thing that's contributing.
Yep.
Is she taking a PPI like a Prilosec, a Nexium, which is inhibiting her getting her nutrients to help keep her bones healthy?
Right.
Yeah, what
any
is
any number of those possibilities?
All of these there's a lot of things here to look at. So, but normally, besides strontium, We like some calcium, not a lot.
Vitamin K2.
Magnesium, vitamin D.
Ipraflavone, which is in Osteothera with Ipraflavone. Yeah.
We like Ostera as well.
Ostera is another
one. Yeah, the hops.
Which has a hops extract. Right. Yeah, that's good
too. So slow down the bone turnover.
Olive leaf, did we say?
Oh, olive leaf.
Yeah,
no, we
olive
didn't
leaf
say
extract.
Olive leaf.
Yeah, olive leaf extract has some anti-osteoporotic effects.
And it would be beneficial to check her DHEA levels, DHEA sulfate.
DHEA is an excellent way to build bone. So.
Right, right. And doing some strength training exercises.
Yeah.
As long as her doctor says she can. Silvio, what a great question. Regards to you and your wife. That's lovely.
It's unfortunately, and we can sort of generalize, but we may want to hone in on that specific case. We would ask ourselves, why did she get there? Why is she at risk?
Okay. Yeah. We've got a few COVID questions here, Dr. Hoffman.
Okay.
Two are asking about, do I have to take the vaccine? Let me just start with Rupert. I'd like to know if you consider the new vaccine safe. Is it necessary to get the vaccine?
It was just announced like last week.
All of a sudden,
do I have to take it?
Do I have to take it?
It was crazy. People are so captivated by this that I went up to the front desk to review the charts and the questions from the past couple of days, and our administrator hands me two charts, and both of them asked the same question. They said, well, what do you think of the vaccine? Should I take it?
Yeah.
And that's going to be a big question.
Right.
So my answer is, I'm very excited that these vaccines work seemingly so well. I mean, a 90% or a 94.5%, efficacy rate, I knocks my socks off. I mean, kudos to them for...
That's better than the flu shot.
A whole lot better than
the
flu shot.
Oh my goodness.
So
that's great.
So my question is, if they work so well, why didn't they come up with a cure for the common cold, which is caused by coronavirus before?
Yeah.
I guess it wasn't that compelling.
Right.
The
common cold
wasn't... So the impetus is there for this. This is a worldwide emergency. There's a lot of money to be made. And so they really raced to do this. And it was also some encouragement from the government.
Yeah.
All right. So now we have these things that seemingly are so efficacious. Mm. And they were testing a lot of people. Maybe 10,000 people. A lot of people took this in the trial. Maybe 30,000 people. I don't know. I have to look at the details. And there weren't any dire side effects. Well, so far, so good.
Yeah.
A couple of observations. One is that drugs never turn out to be as good as the initial trials. The initial trials are often conducted under ideal circumstances where people are relatively healthy.
Yeah.
And not very diverse. And... there's a bit of a bias to show that something is efficacious. It just creeps in, no matter what they do to safeguard against that. So in the real world, things do not work quite as well as they do in trials. The other thing that emerges when you 30, say there's 30,000 people. What happens when 30 million people take that? Do the math. That's 1,000 times more than 30,000 people. When you magnify the potential for side effects by 1,000, what are we going to see?
Yeah.
And, I have a general principle with medications and vaccines is I like to wait until there's what's called post-marketing data.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of reasons to jump into this because this is such a bad thing. We want to get over with this. We want to get our, and we also, there's also, even for people who are not worried about it personally, they may feel that, and we're going to be encouraged to believe this, that we have a personal responsibility to take the vaccine for the sake of our fellow man and
woman. Right, right.
That, we do the right thing, take the vaccine, stop this virus, because you may not be worried about it, but, granny is going to die if she catches it. And so you want to really stop it. I still would wait a little bit. And I think... A lot of people act as if the vaccine, you can go to the CVS and get it right now. You can't.
No, you can't.
And you won't be able to get it for a long time.
FDA is still reviewing, right?
Well, I think it's getting
on the
very
verge.
close to the verge of approval. But the first priority will be to healthcare workers and possibly first responders, and then maybe people in nursing homes, the very vulnerable. And then it'll trickle down. And I'm pretty sure that this is not a question that you're going to have to decide like next week whether to get it, because it won't be available until probably midwinter, practically speaking. And then you can make a decision about whether you want to get it.
Yeah. Good point.
Look, regardless of what you think of the government, I don't think in America there's going to be compulsory vaccination. That just can't happen.
Hope
because
not.
It's going to backfire. Because a lot of people are suspicious of vaccines.
Yes.
And rightly so. But, you know, I'm not going to be an anti-vaxxer, on this subject because
right. yeah.
I think this is a very compelling emergency.
Yes.
And even if there's some very infinitesimal risk attendant to taking the vaccine, I think, ultimately we should all take it.
Mm-hmm.
Or possibly by the time it's available for everyone, maybe that would be the best case scenario, that the virus runs its course.
Yeah.
And then it'd be like, okay, nice, we have a vaccine, but like, we don't need it anymore.
Right.
Then,
right. That would be great.
Then we vaccinate like the most vulnerable, like we just talked about, people who are obese.
Yes.
And not just overweight, but they might have a much worse course. So people with hypertension, cardiovascular disease, maybe have a heart attack. Okay, take it. Because you could get, this could be the coup de grace for you if you get the virus.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, should children get it? Somebody who was like being vetted for the new administration said, well, we're going to have to, was it Cuomo? Yeah, I think Cuomo said this.
Mm.
Governor Cuomo from New York, our distinguished governor, said, well, we're going to have to get 330 million doses of this thing.
Now, America's population.
That's America's population. So does he really think that we need to inoculate six-month-old babies or toddlers with this vaccine? I'm pretty sure that's not the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
That's the least vulnerable population.
Right.
And,
I don't know.
I don't know what he's putting in his pipe and smoking.
Exactly.
I mean, didn't they just legalize marijuana?
Exactly. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
Who knows where this will go? That's not going to happen.
No.
But if we can get a preponderance of the population, of the vulnerable population, vaccinated, mm-hmm. we'll really put some speed bumps into the progress of this virus.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if it is as effective as they say, oh my God, nothing, this is too good to be true. Nothing works 94.5%.
Exactly.
I can't think of...
I wonder if that was a statistical, skewy, statistical, spurious something.
We have to look at the data.
You've got to look at the data.
We have to have a lot of transparency, and I hope that the press and, investigative reporters and scientists, critical scientists, actually look at this in an objective way, because that's the best way to get this accepted, is to have total transparency about this. Not to like minimize side effects or problems.
Yeah.
And not to exaggerate the efficacy.
Right, right.
Anyway, obviously we're going way over. So part one.
Yeah.
That was part one. Part two, we'll have more questions about COVID-19.
Yes, we will.
Right. All right. Mm-hmm. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And we'll be right back with more of today's podcast.